Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's Giannata's sunglasses. Oh, I wish there's Giannata's sunglasses. If he's not his sunglasses, then I'd show you messages hiding before your very eyes.
Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. The Old Mole takes its name from Karl Marx's term for the revolutionary forces that subvert the terrain of capital. That's hard work, but moles are workers. Indeed, the collective noun for a group of moles is a labor. The labor of moles on today's show features some of the most multi-talented and busiest of moles. Our engineer today is Patricia Kullberg, author of On the Ragged Edge of Medicine, Stories from Two Decades of Doctoring Among the Dispossessed. She'll be reading from that work this very evening, Monday, June 26th at 7:30 p.m. at Powell City of Books, 1005 West Burnside Street in Portland. Later, we'll be hearing again from Joe Clement, who performed our opening theme song, when he returns to talk with me about the 1998 animated movie Ants, which you can find at the Multnomah County Library, among other places, and which shows viewers of all ages that when you are confronted with the threat of a fascist takeover, the appropriate response is to organize the workers. Today's show will close with filmmaker, writer, psychologist Mole Jan Hocken talking with musician, philosopher, writer Mole Clayton Morgeridge about his new book, Demystifying Demons, Rethinking Who and What We Are. It's a volume that one reviewer has called a spiritual book for atheists and an engaging and approachable guide for the non-philosopher interested in the big philosophical questions about consciousness. We'll be starting, though, with Bill Resnick talking with Larry Kleinman, a co-founder of the farmworker union Picun and currently an advisor to immigrant rights organizations around the country. They discuss some of the history and recent developments in immigration law, some changes in the experience of immigrants since the Trump administration's unleashing of ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Service, and some of the work in progress to resist and reverse anti-immigration politics. As always, you'll be able to find the podcast of the show and its segments in a day or two on our website at kboo.fm/program/old/hyphen. Anyway, kboo.fm, look for the Old Mole Variety Hour. We invite you to like the Old Mole Variety Hour on Facebook and to follow at Old Mole on Twitter. If you're interested in getting involved with the Mole, or if you have suggestions, comments, or questions, you can reach us via our KBOO webpage or at Old Mole Variety Hour, all one word, at gmail.com. We turn now to Bill Resnick and Larry Kleinman.
Larry Kleinman, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you, Bill. Great to be here.
Larry Kleinman knows immigration in this country. His roots are in the grassroots struggle in Woodburn with Picun, the Oregon Farm Workers Union that he co-founded midway through the last century. Now he spends half his time in Woodburn and half in Washington, D.C. Larry, briefly give us your very honorable and fascinating biography.
Well, I'm happy to be here again on the Old Mole, and I've been doing this work for 40 years. I am a co-founder of Picun, but a little over 3 years ago, went through a leadership transition of generational shift, and I stepped down as Secretary-Treasurer. My successor is Jaime Arredondo, young man whose family have been Picun members his whole life. And I transitioned to a role, a national role, as an advisor and capacity builder to immigrant rights organizations across the country in a network that Ekun is a member of and helped form.
Yeah, and you also work in Washington, D.C., including meetings with growers, with agriculture interests, all the interests who are employing immigrant workers. The great struggle in Washington, D.C. is, and the national struggle and the local struggle, you're involved in both now.
My role in it is not as direct a role as it used to be, perhaps. But
in Woodburn.
Of Bekun, but I am at tables and in conversations that give me some insight into, you know, what's going on these different levels.
Right, and you spent a lot of time in the fields.
That's true.
In Oregon.
And the legislature and organizing allies and so on.
So things have changed now, although it's episodic. It happens every 10 or 20 years.
That's true.
But immigrant communities now are really under attack. Tell us what's happening in immigrant communities all over this country. Worse in some states than others, though.
Absolutely. No, I think that's right. And we all see it and read about it, feel it. Huge spike in fear. Completely understandable that happened with the shock of the election of Donald Trump. The force of all of his propaganda that created this atmosphere of fear and his reversing of Obama-era policies that unleashed ICE.
As bad as ICE was in the Obama era, it's now even worse. Obama backtracked some.
Obama tried to corral ICE in some way, not to eliminate it. I mean, like what I tell people is ICE was arresting people every weekday of every week of the 8 years of the Obama presidency. The difference that happened with the arrival of the Trump administration is that the tactics that ICE uses were restored to the Bush-era tactics. But against the backdrop of the threat of mass deportations, which greatly elevated the threat level, even if the activity level wasn't elevated to the same extent.
And now you've got both threats of mass deportation and increased activity.
That's right, increased activity and activity that feels more random, so that everybody is a target. Even if, in fact, on a practical level, on any given day, most people are not actually a target. So coming to terms, and this is what I think is starting to settle out a little bit in immigrant communities that I'm either in or know about, that now this kind of what is exactly the level of threat, how present is it, how frequent, who is being targeted, is starting to emerge a little more clearly. At first, it was sort of everybody's a target any day of the week.
And terror gripped people, yeah.
Absolutely, and the stories of families that were separated, people taking their kids to school and then being arrested and so on, you know, unbelievable trauma that inflicts. One of the things that is happening in those communities is with the leadership of immigrant rights organizations and others that serve immigrants, people started to try to prepare. What does it mean that we might go to work today and not come home, which has been a reality on some level for many years, but I think in many places because of some of the policies of the Obama administration and some local policies about enforcement of law had been reduced. But now it's back up again, or at least the threat of it, and that's what's changed the atmosphere.
Yeah, the great threat and the terror that almost seemed homicidal was the use of the Clinton-era set of laws. Clinton signed it, in fact. Right. Tell us about that.
This is a law passed during when Newt was leading Congress, an anti-immigrant law.
Newt Gingrich.
Yeah,
and the Republican right-winger.
The previous Republican insurgent. In any event, one of the key provisions that law created was called expedited removal. They changed, first of all, the deportation and started calling it removal. Same thing. But they made it expedited removal, and that allowed the government to conduct what's called in absentia hearings, meaning hearings you are not present at, where you are ordered deported, right? And there are now, to make a long story short, there are a million immigrants, a million out of the 11 million, who are subject to expedited removal, meaning they have previous orders of removal that can be reinstated or enforced with virtually no due process. And that's exactly who ICE is going after now. Why? Because they have to afford them the least amount of legal protection, and legal representation, lawyers and others, can do the least for them.
And they just grab them and put them in detention then, and then make life so miserable in detention that a lot of people decide, I've had it, I can't stand it anymore.
Well, that's the folks that have some possible due process right that sit in detention a long time. The expedited removal folks are arrested as soon as they have what's called a travel document, unless you're a Mexican citizen, in which case they just take you out. I mean, you're gone in the matter of a day.
So this is terrifying, just having somebody grabbed and taken. And they claim, of course, always that there was a crime committed by these people. And the crime, of course, has expanded, the kind of crime that gets you instantly deported.
And in many cases, and there's no separate crime. There's no other activity of during your
just
time.
Just crossing the border.
You have a previous order of removal and you came back. Never mind how long ago it was. That was the thing that changed in 20 years ago, is that they could reinstate that previous order and remove you based on that.
And you have no due process rights at all. You're not going to have a lawyer, and you're not going to have a lawyer.
You can have a lawyer, but your lawyer can't do much for you in that case.
If you get a lawyer, but very few actually even get a lawyer.
That's also true.
Understand.
Right.
So people are terrified, but the terror has now given way to planning for the worst. Even though Homeland Security has grown so immensely, and ICE and the organizations, now the Homeland Security has more, in fact, cops and enforcers than all the other federal law enforcement agencies put together.
Yes.
They are an enormous agency now, but they're sort of hamstrung by, in all sorts of ways, they really have trouble operating. And much of their stuff is still symbolic, right? And people are now beginning to adjust to the worst and trying to lead their lives.
I think their activity is, in fact, objectively much worse this year in the advent of Trump than it was last year. The gap that I think you're describing, though, which I think is right, is the gap between what they're actually able to do and the mega threat of mass deportations that Trump popularized. The combination of those two things in the early days of the Trump administration sent the fear through the roof. It's become apparent, though, in 5 months, exactly what you also said, which is they really don't have the capacity to remove hundreds of thousands of people in a short amount of time. They actually don't have that capacity today, right? For various reasons. They are increasing the number of people they're removing from the interior. They're changing who those people are to some degree, and the number of folks coming in the country is way down. It's dropped off precipitously shortly after the inauguration of Trump.
Oh, yes. And even then, it was much lower.
It was already declining. It was already net negative immigration from Mexico.
Is it true that more people are now leaving?
That's been true for a while. That's not a new thing, but it's accelerated. It's accelerated for two reasons. Number one, there are fewer people coming in, way fewer. Right. Secondly, there are more people leaving. And this is the agenda. We remember Mitt Romney embraced self-deportation.
They're terrifying people and driving them out.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there are a segment of the 11 million who are not doing very well economically, maybe personally, who have something they feel they can go back to. They can't take the stress of the possibility of arrest. And so they decide to pack their bags and leave. I believe, I have no data on this, but I believe it's some hundreds of thousands across the country, but it's only hundreds of thousands. It's not millions of people that are going to do that, because other people are doing a little better. Other people have nothing to go back to, or worse, it's a matter of life or death in the area they left. And the threat day to day in wherever they happen to live does not feel excruciating that they have to make that decision tomorrow. They may have to make a plan, as you said, but they're not actually making the decision to execute it.
This is KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick for The Old Mole. I'm talking to Larry Kleinman, long-term co-founder of PICUN, the Farm Workers Union, headquartered in Woodburn with influence all over the state, particularly, of course, in agricultural areas, organizing people. Larry now is passed the baton to younger PICUN people and is now working in Washington, all over the country actually, helping immigrant rights organizations organize and find their voice and operate strategically. Larry, it seems to me all of these organizations and so many movements and some states who are, in fact, recognize the importance of immigrants as well as the humanity of immigrants as well as the economic benefit of immigrants. Mm-hmm. That's the interesting thing is these states like Arizona, they're in deep trouble because they've driven out so many people. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that. Tell us about these countervailing forces in the immigration struggle.
And that this is not a new phenomenon. Again, in fact, everything we're talking about here, there are some new iterations of it, I guess you could say. But this is an age-old story about the ebbs and flows, both in terms of the role of immigrants, the response to immigrants. That's a bigger conversation for another time. But the sort of state dynamic we saw bust into view more, you know, time back.
Let's remind people of the previous immigration scares. Just remind them of their history, like the Chinese Exclusion Acts, and then the way that Chinese workers were needed to build the railroads so they...
Sure. The Irish, when they arrived, were considered non-white. The German Jews didn't like the Eastern European Jews. The Italians were considered dangerous and needed to be removed.
And exploited.
Right, absolutely. And with the Chinese and with Latin American immigrants, with African immigrants, the issue of race is, of course, engaged. And again, as I said, with the Irish, if it wasn't engaged, it was invented. So many of these mega dynamics are not new.
And there were nativist movements as
Absolutely.
Well, often led by big economic forces in their community that let leash this anger at immigrants in order to first to separate them in their factories and operations and fields, but also to redirect the anger of a lot of the older working classes mm-hmm. who were here, right. mostly white, against the immigrants rather than fighting the people who were maximizing their wealth at the expense of labor.
And these things did not fit together seamlessly. There have been the America First movement, as they called themselves in the 30s, took actions in a white supremacist agenda that we see again today emerging dominant, that actually did not suit the interests of the owning class. We see that again today, where the white supremacist reaction that's being fomented and agitated is actually inconvenient to many of the immigrant labor-dependent economic sectors, and it creates friction in the economy as well as friction in the body politic.
There's so much going on also that counters the Trump agenda and also the corporate agenda.
Mm-hmm.
Movements, especially in some states. Why don't you go over just sort of mm-hmm. the panorama of struggle towards immigrant rights and integration, as well as a very different economy is absolutely necessary in the U.S. and the immigrants' rights movement.
So the state-level focus is not a new thing. It's gotten to a new level, though. So we saw in Arizona SB 1070 in 2010, the knockoff of that in Alabama, HB 56 the following year, and state-level anti-immigrant laws. But we also remember, Bill saw that in California with Proposition 187
sure.
in 1994. So again, this is an old story.
It killed the Republicans later.
It killed them later, that's right. And Democrats remind Republicans today that want to play that card,
yeah.
you know, especially in a place like Texas, right?
Uh-huh.
But that's where ground zero is today as we speak. It's SB 4, a bill just signed by the Governor Abbott, one of the most anti-immigrant, you know, pro-Trump politicians. Basically what SB 4 says is it forces local law enforcement to cooperate with immigration and creates probably the most draconian penalties ever imagined if those local police do not do so. Local police departments that refuse to cooperate in the way described by the law, those local officials would be fined, they would be removed from office, and could be charged with a felony and jailed. The only thing that is not allowed is to execute them. And so there's a huge reaction in Texas. Texas is now ground zero for the anti-immigrant fight on the state level. Very quickly, and the complete opposite of that is California, which has gone the complete opposite direction and is actually creating more protections more quickly, expanding on a base of protections they'd already created.
Providing driver's licenses to undocumented workers.
Creating in law
access
limitations.
To public schools.
That's right.
Yeah.
And scholarships, access to professional licenses.
You can become a lawyer in California without being a citizen then.
Without even having legal status.
Yes.
That's right. So we're seeing an incredible divergence on the state level. I think the hope, at least in Texas, is with the backing of the nation, pro-immigrant forces around the country, that Texas will be the next Arizona. So the kinds of boycotts and pressures and political organizing in Arizona, which is still ongoing, by the way, that ended up removing Joe Arpaio, that I think is making Arizona a more competitive state on a partisan level. The hope is that this will be one of the forces that actually is a catalyst in Texas to take it in a similar direction. But one of the things that has to be overcome is the effects of gerrymandering, which are very deep in Texas and entrenched the Republicans. But they are overplaying their hand politically, I believe. And so I believe we'll see that acceleration. It's not clear how long it'll take.
There's a grassroots side of the two. That was sort of the macro political side in terms of the politics of Washington, D.C. and the state capitals. There's a grassroots side as well. Even in Texas, the reason that they have such draconian penalties on law enforcement for not enforcing is because there's a lot of sanctuary cities, even in Texas,
absolutely,
like Houston.
Right. Houston, Dallas, San Antonio, Austin, El Paso.
Really? I didn't realize it was that big. And in California, of course, it's another story. They, as a state, and in Oregon, although Oregon, of course, is way behind California in so many ways, actually.
Mm-hmm. No, I think you're absolutely right. There are very strong pro-immigrant forces in Texas. They are in the cities. All those cities have Democratic mayors, but they are becoming more aggressive. They have a united cause, and they have the support of now folks across the country. So, for example, the American Immigration Lawyer Association, ALA, the largest association of immigration lawyers, just announced days after SB 4 was signed in Texas, announced that they are moving their convention in 2018, which was going to be in Texas, somewhere else. And that happened in Arizona. Those kinds of things happened in Arizona after SB 1070 in 2010, and they lost tens of millions of dollars of business. National sports event?
Yeah.
Absolutely. No, I think we'll see that national sports events may disinvest or divest, for whether it's NCAA, whether it's all-star games in the professional leagues. Once again, we're going to see this pressure emerge, and because it's Texas, which is way bigger as an economy, as a state, as a demographic, where no ethnic group is a majority in Texas today, right? Latinos are headed to being the plurality in Texas in not very many years. So Texas is going to be ground zero for the anti-immigrant fight.
Well, this is all, the struggle is really interesting. We're going to keep going with it. This is the end of this interview. Larry, thanks a lot. But I think next time we can talk about these forces that are in motion much more deeply, particularly corporate America.
Right.
And also the anti-immigrant economic forces, like the people who create these private prisons. They spend a vast amount of money buying politicians.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me there's a huge struggle going on. We'll talk about all of that.
I think the two big areas where this, for me, this conversation leads, one is what's happening inside the employer side and inside the Republican Party. Secondly, what is the response? The immigrant organizing rights community rightly had to first engage in first response. But I think the first response period, or at least the initial phase of it, is sort of winding down now. And now it's like, what's the longer term strategy against a force as entrenched as Trump, or the forces he's unleashed, and as unpredictable as that? And the question of white supremacy, what does that all mean in Oregon? Those were other themes to then pick up on.
Yeah, and that's against the background of economic transition in lots of
absolutely
ways, where immigrant workers are absolutely essential. This is an aging population in Europe, too. They need the people who they're driving out.
But Larry, to be continued, wonderful to be here with you, Bill. And I look forward to another opportunity here soon to dig into these issues that we've left ourselves wanting more about.
Thank you very much, Larry Kleinman.
I got one job, two job, three when I need them. I got five roommates in this one studio, but I never really see them. And we all came America trying to get a lap dance from Lady Freedom. But now Lady Liberty is acting like Hillary Banks with a prenup.
Banks with a prenup.
Man, I was brave, sailing on graves. Don't think I didn't notice those tombstones disguised as waves. I'm no dummy, here's something funny. You could be an immigrant without risking your lives, or crossing these borders with thrifty supplies. All you gotta do is see the world with new eyes.
Immigrants, we get the job done.
Look how far I come. Look how far I come. Look how far I come.
We get the job done.
Look how far I come. Look how far I come. Look how far I come.
Immigrants, we get the job done.
It's a hard line when you're an import, baby boy, it's hard times. When you ain't sent for braces, feed the belly of the beast with they pitchforks. Rich chores done by the people that get ignored. Ya se armó, ya se despertaron, it's a whole awakening. La alarma ya sonó hace rato, los que quieren buscan, pero nos apodan como vagos. We're the same ones hustling on every level, ten los datos. Walk a mile in our shoes, abróchense los zapatos. I've been scoping y'all dudes, y'all ain't been working like I do. Why y'all work ya? It hurt ya. You claim I'm stealing jobs, oh, Peter Piper claimed he picked them, he just underpaid Pablo. But there ain't a paper trail when you living in the shadows. We America's ghost riders, the credit's only borrowed. It's a matter of time before the checks all come. But
immigrants, we get the job done.
Look how far I come.
That was the song Immigrants, We Get the Job Done, from the soundtrack to Hamilton by Lin-Manuel Miranda. Before that, we heard Bill Resnick and Larry Kleinman discussing recent developments in immigration policy and pushback. They'll be back on The Mole next week to continue that discussion about grassroots resistance and the ways that the American economy depends on the labor of immigrants. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, your listener-sponsored, volunteer-powered community radio station. I'm your host today, Fran Michel. And for our next segment, I'm joined by Joe Clement to talk about the animated film Ants.
I'm Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm joined by
Fran Michel for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
We're going to talk about an older film, older being 20 years old, Ants. It was released in 1997 as one of the first digitally engineered films. Toy Story was the one really big box office hit, and a couple of few years later, we got Ants. It was directed by Eric Darnell and Tim Johnson and stars this like incredible smorgasbord of well-known actors playing voice actors. Woody Allen is the main character, Z. It is a film about ants. Z is an ant, one of millions, it's suggested, who is very alienated and nervous and just out of sync with society and feels oppressed and dominated. And the movie is the story of his coming to terms with that alienation and how it is not just him, it's not just his personality. It is a product of the society that he lives in, which is this collectivist one that is tending towards a kind of fascism. And it's a kind of silly story because it's about ants, but it talks about classes and social distinctions as if they're humans. But we both like it for this reason, because the way it helps make what is familiar unfamiliar again.
Yeah, there's a lot to like about this film, which ends with the statement that it's just your typical boy meets girl, boy gets girl, boy changes underlying social structure story. It works well for both adults and kids. There are a lot of really funny one-liners. There's a lot of, you know, shtick from Woody Allen. There are some bad words, so parents might want to be aware of that. But there's a lot in it about sort of the relation between the individual and the community, about the role of work, about, you know, how to deal with a fascist takeover or attempted fascist takeover, which is a timely concern. It has to do with, you know, sort of finding your place in collectivity and our shared power and the commons and that kind of stuff. It's got a lot of fun play with the visuals, with changes in perspective, which I think is also related to the question of changes in perspective in the story. Whose version of events are we going to adhere to? It opens with some of those one-liners of Woody Allen on the couch talking to his shrink about the idea that he's always felt insignificant because, after all, he never got his mother's attention because he was the middle child of 5 million, which is a line that, right, sort of undercuts the notion of psychoanalysis and the sort of intensive focus on one's own psyche that Woody Allen is sort of famous for engaging in, although in a self-mocking way. But he says he feels so insignificant. His shrink says, you've made a great breakthrough. You've realized you are insignificant.
And that is itself an expression of the dominant culture. And in that moment, the shrink, I think, very clearly kind of starts to stand out as like another one of these voices that is telling him this and that he realizes he needs to not believe. And he is a worker. The worker ants seem to only really dig. They aren't making food. Some of them are tending a bar in the ridiculous ant dance club that they have, which we'll talk a little bit more about. But the workers are essentially just digging. And he is a friend, or is befriended with another ant who is a part of the soldier class, who's played by Sylvester Stallone. And they have this very they're like brothers. They're born 2 seconds apart, and I think that is part of expressing their bond, that they met before they were socially conditioned to be their class. We see early in the film that all babies who are being pumped out of the Queen every 10 seconds, it is said, are given a iconic thing. The soldiers get a helmet, the workers get a pickaxe, and so in that moment before that happens, you can really kind of sense that that's where they met, that's where they encountered, and then they have this lifelong friendship. And they're both pushing and pulling on each other about like their different kind of perspectives on being part of this ant society.
So although in one sense, the movie is about this society that is tremendously regimented, in fact, biologically regimented, right, that they become physically different. I mean, we see the worker ants are smaller and lighter and shorter and thinner than the big muscular military ants that are the soldier ants. But much of the movie is about the ways that the characters or the plot turns on characters crossing those boundaries and those lines. So Z meets Princess Bala, the princess of the colony, when she goes slumming and comes into the ant worker bar, and they dance together, not in the regimented lines. But that's where he first sees her, and then because he wants to see her again, he convinces Weaver to switch places with him because there's going to be a parade of the soldiers past the palace. So the plot turns on the possibility of crossing these lines.
You know, Bala coming to the bar is kind of a classic trope in stories that have anything to do with class, and that is one of the biggest things this film has to do with. We could say it has to do with race in some ways, but in a way, it's really focused on class. And so when Bala comes down to the bar, she's repeatedly like talking about the workers. She has this very objectified view of them. She keeps just referring to them as their class and how she's going to go and enjoy the workers. And there is this sense in which like the workers are like the real people. They are the ones who actually get to enjoy life. She's lamenting this to her mother when they're having their own kind of old generation, new generation kind of debate about like what's the future of people in our class. And so she goes to the bar to try and basically get an injection of the real life from the masses. And in that moment, she kind of starts to realize things about herself, and Z realizes things about the potential of others to actually be interesting and unique. Bala's interesting and unique, though, because she is purebred. She's aristocracy. And Z is unique because he's always typecast as this oddball.
As you say, it's much more about class than race or gender. And I mean, the movie is trying and I think succeeding in saying some interesting things about class and playing with those lines and whether nature is dynamic, whereas it's not particularly playing with lines around gender or race, where it seems to really conform to some of the more conventional tropes and structures and narratives of heterosexual romance and of, right, sort of typecasting of characters of color. Although, of course, the ants are ant-colored, which is kind of a brownish, tannish color. But there's one soldier who kind of takes Z under his wing. He's voiced by Danny Glover. His name is Barbatus, which sounds a lot like Barbados. I mean, he's clearly, right, he's the African-American ant. And then one of Z's worker friends is voiced by Jennifer Lopez, and her name is
Azteca.
Yeah, so they're not, you know, they're not working on playing with those things, actually, at all. And, you know, the princess is princessy. And, of course, I mean, it's a cartoon about ants.
The big story that really drives the whole narrative is that there is a general named General Mandible who is voiced by Gene Hackman, and he has a plan to create a purified colony. He wants to kill off a lot of the ants, probably lots of workers, and build a stronger colony. And the film is definitely taking head on this question of the state, of the struggle for the state between fascist forces and worker forces.
Yeah. Well, the worker forces, though, are represented in the terms of the state by the queen and the royal house. Right. I mean, it's the old story of the peasants' rebellion being aligned with the king. as far as we know, it's, you know, there's still a queen. It's still a monarchy. It's not a workers' collective, but it's a much more benign monarchy by the end, it seems. And it's resisted, right? The state has resisted state as structured by the benevolent feminine monarch who believes in diplomacy and working with your enemies if you can, as opposed to the fascism, the militarism, the violence of the general who intentionally sends out the soldiers ants who are loyal to the queen to die in battle against the termites so that he can promote this alternate version of the colony in which only the strong survive. And he and Bala can get married, and apparently all the workers will be drowned.
Yeah, so that's why overall the film does not present like the right revolution. But what's really fun about it is how it really drives at the question of worker power in society, and not in an abstract sense, but really bringing it home to the fact that it's, you know, we who are putting our hands on the machines, on the tools, on the materials, who are the direct conduits of all of the power of society, increasingly mediated by machines, but still the machines, you know, have buttons that we're pressing, and that this is the fundamental fact of our power. And there's this really great scene in the middle where people start talking about this.
Yeah. Well, and on the technology question, it's also the case, of course, that the buttons and the machines have been built by workers, that workers are the machine. Ultimately, if you trace it back, it all comes back to labor. And there's a moment in the film when the other ants are worker ants are starting to realize that they don't necessarily have to keep digging, that there might be another choice. And we actually have an ant saying, the workers control the means of production. Like, how many films do you hear that line in? How many mainstream Hollywood films that families go to and play in multiplexes that you can find on Netflix include somebody saying, quite seriously, as a principle of discovery, that the workers control the means of production? Quite true.
And this anti-work kind of attitude or attitude of agency is repeated again and again. There's this great scene towards the end where some of the workers have been asked to stop digging because they were going to open up a lake to flood into the tunnel they're in. And a manager comes by and says, hey, you all get back to work. And they just look at him and they say, why? And it's moments like that that I think make the film worth watching because, again, this is a kid's film. It's a kid's film which, in its time, was bridging that gap between kids' films and films that appeal to adults. And yet, it works best as a series of different vignettes and lessons about these tropes and processes that play out between individuals and the society they're in.
And I think it really does emphasize the way that individuals find themselves as an individual. One finds oneself through community and through solidarity and through working with others. In ants, all the technology, all the machines are the ants themselves. There's a wrecking ball. It's made out of ants. The chain that holds it up is made out of ants. The colony is saved at the end by making a ladder out of ants. That they are the technology. So, I mean, there's a real emphasis on the importance of their collective participation in their shared action in taking control of their lives and saving themselves.
That in itself is worth highlighting because obviously the fascists were also in a way trying to organize workers to fascist ends. The fascies, the symbol of fascism, is this bundle of sticks from many one, the strength of the many one, and that represents a certain, you know, notion of collective power. And Z and his ostensible kind of anarcho-syndicalist revolutionary attitude represents a different way of finding power in the group.
There's a moment near the end of the film when the workers have escaped or about to escape, but they need a little bit more help, and the general wants them to give it up and basically die for the good of the colony. And Z says, we are the colony. And
the general says, I'm the colony.
Right. Statement of tyrants everywhere. I am the state. And that is overthrown.
Well, I think that's all the time we have for this on-air portion of our conversation about the 1997 film Ants,
which you can find at the Multnomah County Library. We'll keep talking about this online. How about that?
We didn't even talk about Insectopia. Do you know there's an Insectopia in this film? And they go there. You can find this conversation with an extended portion at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour in a day or two.
Guess what makes that little old ant think he'll move that rubber tree plant? Anyone knows an ant can't move a rubber tree plant, but he's got high hopes. He's got high hopes. He's got high apple pie in the sky hopes. So anytime you get low, instead of letting go, just remember that ant. Oops, there goes another rubber tree plant. Oops, there goes another rubber tree plant. Once there was a silly old ram, thought he'd punch a hole in a dam. No one could make that ram scram. He kept butting that dam, 'cause he had high hopes. He had. Remember that ram.
Oops, there goes a billion kilowatt.
Oops, there goes a billion kilowatt.
Oops, there goes a billion kilowatt.
So keep your high
hopes. That was, of course, Doris Day singing about the pan-animal solidarity that goats have displayed with salmon and their important contributions to dam removal. Also before that, Joe Clement and I talking about the movie Ants. As we said, you can find that discussion and more online in a day or two. You'll want to visit the Old Mole Variety Hour pages on the website for KBOO Portland at kboo.fm to get our shows, segments, and links to more information. You can also find those by visiting, liking, and following the Old Mole Variety Hour on Facebook and following us at Old Mole on Twitter. Last, but not at all least today, we hear from Moles Jan Hocken and Clayton Morgridge for a discussion of Clayton's new book, Demystifying Demons, Rethinking Who and What We Are. Jan and Clayton?
Well, Clayton, in addition to years of volunteering here at KBOO, primarily on the Old Mole Show, you bring to this book project many years of experience as a philosophy professor at Lewis and Clark. And having thought deeply about how to apply philosophy to problems in human living, the book is titled Demystifying Demons and works at the borders of philosophy and psychology, which interested me a great deal, how you bring psychology into a book that's kind of structured for kind of formally like a philosopher, but takes up much more material than you would find in a normal philosophy textbook. And I think it brings somewhat of a tone of ambivalence toward your own profession and addressing what's missing in philosophical arguments. And so we'll like to talk with you about that today. But you also make clear in the introduction that this is not a guide to living or self-help manual, even though you're clearly interested or have in mind a kind of practice as a philosopher that does attend to problems in human suffering. Mm-hmm. So tell us about what demons you're trying to demystify here, because you're talking about things that are maybe difficult to bear in mind in human consciousness, but also maybe to bear in mind in philosophy.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, I guess I first want to make clear that the book is certainly by a philosopher, and it has a sort of a philosophical structure behind it. It's not written for philosophers, and it doesn't try to engage people's intellectual or conceptual puzzles in the way that philosophy often does. But as you said, the problems of real people's lives. And it sort of began with my own puzzlement about why I couldn't understand or control my own mind in ways that it seemed like I was expected to be able to do. That what I was supposed to be like as a student, for example, in school was to be hardworking and take my classes very seriously. And I wanted to do that, but yet I found a lot of resistance in myself to doing that. And I couldn't quite understand, I couldn't understand at all, where this resistance came from or why I resented so much that I resented about that those demands. And also just a lot of anxiety that I couldn't quite locate or understand what the reason for it was.
And indeed, your book seems to be a gift to your former self,
that's right, a young Clayton,
like many young people struggling to find their way in the world and to develop a stable, maybe conscience, a set of values. Eric Erickson talked about that transition to adulthood and making commitments, and that there's something important and vital about what Freud called the superego or a sense of conscience. Mm-hmm. But you're saying it has this other side to it.
Yeah, a very judgmental side. And so I went on then, as you mentioned, to study philosophy as an adult or young adult. And because I was interested in these big questions about human nature and how society is put together and why we're supposed to do the things that we're supposed to do. But philosophy generally assumed that whatever was in the mind was there to be perceived, I mean, was conscious, and which didn't seem to be the case. And it focuses on our thoughts insofar as they can be controlled by reason. And it seemed to me that an awful lot of our thought is not controlled by reason and don't arise from rational sources. So I then turned to psychoanalysis, and that seemed right because it does focus on the unconscious, on things that we that are going on in us that we don't know where we don't know that they're there, but they have a huge impact on us or a lot of control over us. But yet, at the same time, in reading people like Freud, I could never quite identify with that theoretical structure. I didn't quite see myself in the struggles between id, superego, and ego, and so forth, because I don't know, it just seemed too theoretical or abstract or something. So I kind of was searching for a way to explain to myself and to other people, like people like my students, the unconscious side of ourselves. And by beginning with ordinary experience that everybody shares, and that's something I always try to do when teaching difficult topics and philosophies, to bring it down to things that the student already experienced. And so that's one side of it, was sort of my personal experience and the question of the puzzlement about the unconscious. But then another side of this, which was I was disturbed by the in the way society works, by the dominant assumption that I think is an important part of our ideology, or of, you know, capitalist ideology, if you want, that each of us is individually responsible for our attitudes and our beliefs and the actions that result from them.
Our whole criminal justice system is based on that premise.
Exactly. And so this makes the assumption, again, that we know why we think and feel as we do, and that we can control what we think and feel. And this is part of the ideology of domination, because it blinds us to the way in which our minds and or our souls, as I like to say, are shaped and determined by the economic order we live in, or even more strongly, that our souls are inseparable from our relationships with the world at large, with the structures of the world, and with and with other people. So I wanted to develop an understanding of the soul as a deeply social thing that lives and breathes in relationships with others.
So when you use the term soul or demons, you're using them in secular traditions to refer to something deeply held.
That's right, yeah.
That has some sustaining presence. Mm-hmm. And it's always difficult to find language for that.
That's
even
right.
Even consciousness, you know, neuroscience isn't even close to unpacking how we understand the phenomenology of consciousness. But you're trying to capture something at that level of deeply held experience.
Mm-hmm.
And
the
way in which this, you're also addressing some of the limits that come with that, because there are romantic traditions of thinking about soul, or even angels and demons that speak to kind of the creative potential of human beings. But you kind of focus, you do address that, particularly as you work through what you call the negative emotions. Can you say something about what these more disturbing emotions that conflict with a kind of ideal self encompass?
Right. Well, the demons that I name and particularly try to analyze and trace back to their origins in our early childhood are rage, guilt, self-loathing, anxiety, and a deep sense of insecurity, or what R.D. Lang calls ontological insecurity. And my the kind of explanation that I try to offer for these is that in early childhood, it's inevitable that there are times when we are frustrated as infants.
Or the environment will fail us in some way, or our caregivers.
Exactly. And I really like Donald Winnicott's phrase, tremendous things happen in the little world of the baby. Because I think we don't, as adults, we don't have any appreciation for what's going on in the experience of an infant who is asked to wait to be picked up or to be fed for a long time. I mean, many of us were raised at a time when there was the idea that you shouldn't be fed until 4 hours had passed, no matter what how loud you screamed. And so there's a degree of rage, I mean, a powerful amount of rage that children feel, and it's directed in a way at their parents, whom they love and depend upon, but then that occasions, guilt for feeling so angry and even destructive at the way things are, at the world on which you depend.
Freud once said, one of my favorite lines is, we all want to remain His Majesty the baby, yeah. Maybe Her Majesty the baby, and that we never relinquish childhood as fully as we believe in as
right.
Humans enter adult life. And you really follow that as well, that
yeah.
line of thought, and
yeah.
how disturbing that is to discover how many of the wanting to be the center of someone else's world and feeling slighted, or the anxiety about being loved, or mm-hmm. and maybe envy is part of this as well. How these feelings that are so associated with childhood are not always incorporated easily into adulthood, and particularly maybe what you're talking about, a kind of Western ideal that is laden with kind of patriarchal masculine fantasies as well. That's about maturity.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that we grew up, I mean, even as I was saying, like as a sixth grade student or a fourth grade student, feeling that I should be in control of myself and that I should be reasonable, but yet feeling all of these contradictory impulses. And so it was like I was supposed to be an adult already, but yet there was something that was infantile, but that was extremely disturbing. And I think that happens for many of us, for possibly for all of us, that we're disturbed in our attempt to present ourselves as reasonable, responsible adults, while feeling sort of this desire to, you know, kick and scream and complain about the world.
So how did you bring some of these ideas into left politics? Because I think some of these are familiar to people who read, who follow lines of psychological thought that deal with the unconscious. But you also take some of this into what it means to try to change the world, to do a better job in the world, which also requires certain ideals and mm-hmm. that we don't live up to in social movements,
right.
And in some ways a superego that demands something of us.
Yeah. There's another side of infantile life, which is the desire for love, to love and to be loved and to be a part of an affectionate community. It begins with our relationship with our mothers, but then it grows and expands. And
people bring that into social movements, those.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that one thing that we can do that expresses that love is to understand that we are all victims or survivors of these of difficult childhoods, and nobody is perfect, nobody is pure, and that what we need to do is to develop a way of living, both in our movements, but then also aiming towards a better world that is organized around love, without the expectation that everybody is going to be perfect all the time.
And that can be a dynamic in social movements, particularly if there is, you talk about the big bad other, where those unacceptable parts of oneself are then projected outward, or you begin to rely on the opposition in order to feel good about yourself and your group. We're good, they're bad. Can you say a bit about that? And we have, of course, plenty of material for that these days. We've got a really big bad other going on with this administration. But there's some cautionary
notes
you have toward that
dynamic. I mean, I think that all sides of the political spectrum tend to identify their group as the good and the other groups as bad, and that somehow the world as it must be someday has to be when we're the good people in charge and the others are somehow vanquished or subdued. But I think, again, just that say trashing everybody who voted for Trump, for example, is a bad idea.
Yeah.
That we need to try to understand where they're coming from, and try to develop a politics that will be inclusive
and more empathic, and maybe understanding of how difficult it is, this project of a social transformation, given what people bring to it. Well, in closing, I just want to make sure people know where our listeners know where to get the book. It's a fabulous book by, I call, sage and savvy philosopher.
Thank you, Jen.
The kind of philosophy that we all wanted to take in college but didn't get in those classes that were impossibly abstract. It's called Demystifying Demons, Rethinking Who and What We Are. And you can get it by ordering it on Amazon by Clayton Morgridge. Thanks so much for being here today and talking about your work, and congratulations.
Thank you very much, Jan. I really enjoyed this.
My mind's got a mind of its own. Takes me out of walking when I'd rather stay at home. Takes me out to parties when I'd rather be alone. Lord, my mind's got a mind of its own.
Thanks for listening today to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Thanks to Jan Hocken and Clayton Morgridge for their discussion of his book, to Joe Clement for talking with me about ants, to Bill Resnick and his guest Larry Kleinman for their discussion of immigration law and history, politics, and practice. They'll be back with part two of that next week. Thanks to Patricia Kullberg for engineering. I'm Fran Michel. I've been your host today. The Mole will be back next Monday with more views, reviews, and interviews. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.